continue to do particularly around the monitoring of performance, we do see a need to focus on some of the organizational human resource matters which are contained in the draft amendment bill. At the same time, one of the issues that we would expect to come up, and indeed has come up in preliminary discussions we've had with various stakeholders, is that if we are working currently on legislation on the Single Public Service, why then would we come with an amendment to the Public Service Act? I think the truth of the matter is that the envisaged legislation for the Single Public Service would be introduced into Parliament in 2008, with the likely date of commencement in 2009. But in the meantime, what do we do? What do we do if we want to achieve the objectives of the developmental state? What do we do if we want to achieve all the objective programs, projects, plans laid out in government program of action to realize the vision articulated in the present state of the nation addressed and so on? We believe that we do need to strengthen the Public Service Act urgently in a number of areas. And this is because some of the organizational and human resource arrangements in the public service directly hamper internal efficiency and service delivery. One of these would be the existing provisions for the deployment of staff. I think there is an increasing recognition that in a context of scarce skills, in a context of limited human resources available for the implementation of government programs, we do need to have provisions which would enhance our ability to deploy staff in a manner that is fair to the priority areas of service delivery. At the same time, certain functions which are provided by departments are not programmed to be computed. We know that if we compare the Public Service Act to the Public Finance Management Act, the Public Finance Management Act has much stronger compliance and accountability measures built into it than the Public Service Act. And hence we believe that some of the organizational and HR practices and the weakness of these is related to the absence of adequate compliance mechanisms within the Public Service Act. At the same time, the Act as currently constituted does lead to legal disputes, some of which are unnecessary. It could be streamlined through the amendments that we have proposed. There's also a concern across government, across the public service, in Parliament, in Chapter 9 institutions, in the Public Service Commission, around issues of integrity and corruption. When employees in the current system transgress, when they are disciplined, they may simply resign before their case even comes to fruition or is concluded, and in the space of a few months rejoin the public service and not face any sanction for transgressions they might have committed, some of which might be quite serious. And we really need to find ways of dealing with this problem if we are going to create the professional, disciplined public service that we want to create. At the same time, employees who are dismissed from misconduct, even if this is corruption, may be re-employed. And we really need to consider if this is a desirable practice, and have in place the necessary legal mechanism to restrict this kind of scenario. At At the same time, we believe that some of the provisions, as I've indicated, have resulted in legal disputes, some are obsolete, some are very complex, and some may even be in conflict with other legislation. And hence, we felt it prudent to review the Public Service Act and to come up with amendments to that Act, even prior to the legislation of the Single Public Service. With that, Chairperson and Honourable Members, I would like to hand over to the legal team to take us through the detailed explanation of the various issues, beginning with the question of definition. Thank you very much.
Over to you, Karen.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. With your permission, I would like to suggest that after each area that we discussed, that we may be forceful for questions, clarifications, and questions, and also questions in the actual provision. So all of my colleagues would stop after each of the areas and indicate that we'll ask if there were any questions. First of all, if you look at the bill, you see that you propose to look at the
I'm afraid people are told that we may have a problem in terms of the conflict. You find that the question that you want to make in one sentence gets clarified when you get to the other thing. So it would be an issue to the next stage of all of it. If you notice that at the end, then we will then have.
First of all, the definition section we propose to take in total, to a large extent, the amendments are not substantial in nature. It's to basically clarify some of the definitions, and then one or two are new definitions.
Okay. The bill comes in, I think it's causing a lot of whatever, it's in just behind. Can you come maybe over here? If I'm wrong, then this was a telling. You said court after now, small court, you know. Yeah. A little bit more simple, yeah.
As indicated, we propose to take the whole definition section, and this to highlight some of the amendments proposed in that clause 1. It is proposed that the term executive authority be used, or defined and used throughout the Act instead of executive authority. So this is then would be the same as the Public Finance Management Act. Executive authority in the context of the Act means, in the case of a national department, the relevant minister, in the case of the province, the office of premier, the premier, and in the case of other provincial departments, it is the relevant MEC. And then you would note from the Act, current Act, that there are several powers are based in executing authority. Another definition which is actually new, it's not a current definition, it's definition of employment practice. This definition is aligned to what you define the Employment Equity Act. It's to include a number of issues such as conditions of service, performance management, training, development, job training, etc. It's not that broad of a definition, it's simply say employment practice increased. And so it's quite a wide phrase. It's meant to be wide in the context it's used in the bill. Then also what you would notice that these currently definitions of just services and services becomes somewhat confusing when people read the legislation. So the proposed new definitions in relation to the police service, defense force, educators, correctional services, and also intelligence services. The my aim is to clarify, it's not just a main issue in respect of these sectors. And then it's also confusion more relating to the regulations, the definition of salary level and salary scale. Now, currently there's only one salary scale in the public service, as we know, determined, but it's possible that more than one salary scale could be determined for instance of people to pay more cars for their health professions in the future. Salary levels is the level for in that scale. Currently there's 16 levels on the scale that we have, just as an example. Those are the definitions. Then the next clause that's proposed to be amended is Section 2 of the Act that deals mainly with the powers of the Minister of Public Service and Administration and also with the powers of executing authority. Now the first proposal relates to the power of the Minister of Public Service and Administration to apply after consultation with the relevant ministers certain conditions of service to these three sectors, educators, the police service and correctional services. Just to explain why we left out defense and intelligence services, and neither of them are subject to the Labour License Act, in particular the Defence Force has its own bargaining arrangements. They are not subject to the Public Service Ordinance and Bargaining Council's collective agreement. Now the main aim of this provision is to obtain where desirable greater alignment in the conditions of service of the general public service and these sectors. Because obviously sometimes disparities lead to distractions between employees to respond to each, sometimes in cases to lead to employees being similar work, but some of them employed in terms of the Public Service Act while others employed in terms of the Police Service Act. And then it comes to macro benefits like pension and medical aid, in some instances might be desirable for services, you know, as far as possible, different conditions of service. We know also note from the current act there's a long list of areas in respect of which the minister may determine policy. We propose that we'd rather use the word norms and standards, and of course in order to be effective to the policies must be put into legislation, either as original or supporting legislation such as regulations, or alternatively directives or determinations. So what we did is that we revised that list to make it more clear, and then also particularly refer to the determination of norms and standards on corruption. And corruption-related issues, conduct and ethics. And then also we clarified the use of the term information technology and proposed that the term electronic government rather be used, and there's also a new definition in clause 1 saying the electronic government. So it's essentially the use of technology to improve internal efficiency and also deliver services to the public. An additional provision in the clause to that is proposed is the power for the Minister of Public Services to advise the consultative body to advise the minister or as a forum to consult, but only relating to those the functions of the Minister of Public Service administration, for instance on e-government or on corruption, and where there's a need to establish such a body. I think come to an important area, and this is also seen in relation to the previous slide, which deals with the powers of the Minister of Public Service and Administration. Whenever the Minister exercises the power in terms of the Act, whether making regulations or making determination or issuing directives, those powers must be exercised subject to collective bargaining on matters of mutual interest. Now, what we proposed in the bill is merely to clarify this provision. We're not amending the substance of it, because there's four references to an old provision of the previous act that's supposed to place. The collective bargaining in the public service takes place for some various issues in the Public Service Ordinance and Bargaining Council, the name of the PCDC. well, particularly in areas relevant to the sector takes place in a relevant sectoral bargaining council. And currently there's four sectoral bargaining councils. There's a general one and one for education, one for police, and then also one for health and welfare. So for the general public service, particularly relating to the general public service will take place in the general public service for bargaining council. But issues like salary, for instance, are always negotiated in the public service for ordinance and bargaining council. And these structures are created by and in terms of the Labour Relations Act, and so they're not created in terms of the Public Service Act. And that act determines what could be transverse issues to be negotiated. So whatever the Court of Minister may ask, first it must be in line with the current collective agreement. And secondly, if it's a matter that pertains to matters of mutual interest, it must first, collective bargaining must first take place. And that's to clarify that. Then something else that we now propose in the bill is that we've been advised by the law advisors that whenever this collective agreement concluded in one of these councils, then subsequently the minister must issue a determination. And that often leads to delays in implementation, because these things must prepare subsequent to conclusion of the agreement. And sometimes there's also some detail in terms of administration that we often need to arrange as well. So what we propose now is that all collective agreements that are concluded in respect of employees falling under the Public Service Act should be regarded as ministerial determination. So the moment the agreement is concluded, it will be immediately be a determination and there's no need to issue a subsequent determination. And then later on you will note that we also propose provisions to enhance compliance with determination. So if the collective agreement is now also ministerial determination, you can also use compliance measures in the Public Service Act. Obviously there's other measures in terms of the Labour Relations Act that you could use, but this would be an additional measure that could be used. And then another area which you may not easily notice just by reading the bill, but there is a proposal that you delete all references to promotion in the Public Service Act. And this is just, I want to give an indication of the background relating pertaining to this matter. Now currently, in terms of the public service regulations, all senior management service posts must be advertised outside public service, so it's open for the public to apply. And then there's a discretion to do the same for other posts. So it may be advertised only internally for certain posts, but there's still a discretion to do outside public service. So there is a general principle of open competition that we do apply in the public service. Now what happens if an existing employee applies for a higher post in the public service and he or she is successful, then he's regarded to be promoted. Now the question is what happens if an existing employee applies and is unsuccessful. In terms of the definition of unfair labour practice in the Labour Relations Act, a person is entitled to loss of dispute regarding unfair conduct relating to promotion. So an existing employee that's unsuccessful would be able to use this remedy. While on the other hand, an external candidate is not in that position, and so there's no promotion for him. He's applying from outside. So we think there's inequality in terms of remedies available to these employees. And we propose that internal candidates be placed in the same position as external candidates, so that neither of them would be in a position to declare an unfair labour practice dispute. And therefore this proposal that references in the Public Service Act promotion be admitted. But it's important to remember that there is four remedies for these employees. First of all, if they state that there's discrimination, that discrimination occurred in relation to the interview conducted by the particular department or some other form of, or in relation to other step in the process, they may be used in the Employment Equity Act, the remedies under that Act. And currently that entails attracting the CCMAs and not our bargaining side, which they don't have a position on these kind of issues. And then secondly, the broad protection provided by the Minister of Justice Act for all actions of departments must be in accordance with that act, and obviously also the constitutional rights declared in this act. But I can use these remedies and then therefore apply as currently to both internal and external candidates. Make a motion of that provision. Now, in terms of government agencies, you will notice there's quite a lot indicated by the Director General about government agencies. It's a new proposal that's included in the bill to give you background, and then then as a part of to expand the current institutions that you will find under the Public Service Act. First of all, you will find national departments and offices of the Premier, which are listed in Schedule 1 to the Public Service Act. And then you will find provincial departments, which are listed in Schedule 2, and then organizational components, which are listed in Schedule 3. Now, currently, there are only three organizational components, and I'll come back to them later on. Now, these institutions, just to explain how they're established, or disestablished by the President by proclamation in the UK. So once this is done, particular schedules are obviously amended to the Act. So it's not an amendment goal that's required for these changes. For instance, in the past, we split departments into two: arts, culture, and science and technology, and name changes like status that became status and constitutional development, all done in through proclamation by the President. Obviously, the offices of the Premier are fixed, so there's no changes to those offices. This proposal regarding government agencies, as indicated by the DC, it's a new organizational form that we propose. But it must be made clear that this is something within the public service, it's not outside the public service. Now, this proposal comes from proposals made by from the report or review conducted by National Treasury and our department in respect of national public entities. I think that the main features of such agencies, now the head of the agency will report directly to the relevant executive authority, it's either a minister, premier, or MEC. And this head would also be the accounting officer of that agency in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. Now, each agency will have a principal department linked to that agency, which will assist the executive authority with oversight over that agency. So if you look at this in full, my simple, this is my department currently being practiced. But the differences will become apparent later. As indicated, agencies will be part of the public service, and the public service act in all its precepts will apply to the organization and governance of these agencies, as well as its staff. So the staff will therefore be public service employees, they will be appointed under the Public Service Act, and all the other arrangements regarding staff will be determined in terms of the Public Service Act. And then also important is that the matters of mutual interest pertaining to these employees, my conditions of service, will be subject to collective bargaining in the Public Service Organizing Bargaining Council, as I explained earlier, and the relevant sectoral bargaining council. It will depend on the which sectoral bargaining council they will fall under. One would imagine that, for instance, if Department of Health creates such an agency, that they will resort under the Health and Welfare Sectoral Bargaining Council, the employees of this agency. As to the manner of the creation of these agencies, they will be created in terms of the public service, similar to a national or provincial department. Um, And also, what kind of functions and roles that the agency has? Now they may have either regional assigned or delegated statutory functions. And I explain the difference between these three. The original functions will be functions conferred directly on the head of that agency or the agency itself. Assigned functions would be functions conferred on the relevant executive authority, or executive authority, or the official of the central department for national legislation. There's a reason that these functions might be assigned to the head of the agency in terms of their management role. Just to give one example, but this is not, I must say, this is the intention, but to use the unemployment insurance fund. Currently, the DG of Labor has certain powers in respect of the UAS, and those powers could then be delegated to the head of the assigned to the head of that agency. Similarly, also delegated functions conferred on executive authority or the head of the central department could be delegated to the head of the agency. But when it comes to the financial powers in respect of that agency and the HR powers, that will be original powers for that head, except to the extent that those powers rest in the relevant executive authority. Now, this is showing the difference between assigned and delegated functions. Now, when a function delegates certain functions, say there was a function that is delegated and remains accountable. Well, if a person or function assigns certain functions, they are no longer accountable for those functions, and the person to whom the powers are assigned becomes accountable. So those are the differences. Now to come to the assignment of powers, this is in use to government agencies. Our reasoning behind was when it comes to the assignment of functions, for instance, following certain powers to a future DG or executive authority, then Parliament was of the view that that function is best place to exercise that function. So therefore, you can only take those powers away, for instance, from a minister or from the head of the central department and give it to the head of the agency with Parliament itself approval. So you see a long process described in the bill if that assignment is to take place and the role of Parliament in that process. And then the other requirement is eventually Parliament approves such an assignment and it must be done by notice in the Gazette. So that the public can know that this function is no longer a function of, for instance, the Minister of Labour, it's now a function of the head of a government agency falling under the portfolio of the Minister of Labour. To continue further with government agencies, the proposal is that these agencies be listed in Schedule 3 together with the principal department. So there will be three columns, the one, the name of the agency, the principal department, and then also the designation of the head of the agency. The first proposed agency you will find in the amendment bill is the Centre for Public Service Innovation, which is currently a component of our department. Previously it was a 1621 company. Now the proposal is that our department be the principal department for that agency, and then obviously the Minister of Public Service and Administration would be the executive authority of this agency. Then the head of the centre will be the accounting officer and will have all the accounting powers. Now just to highlight something in relation to the current aspect, if you look at the entities or institutions listed in Schedule 1, National Departments and Organizational Components listed in Schedule 3, apart from the different designation and name, there's no difference legally between the two of them. So therefore we propose that the current Schedule 3 bodies be moved to Schedule 1. Now those are the Independent Compliance Directors, Intelligence Academy and Inspectorate for Social Assistance. So the government agencies will be in Schedule 3 and then these current ones will be moved to Schedule 1. Then, just to elaborate a bit about the process on how these agencies will be created, that the proposal is similar to departments, it will be created by the President by proclamation in the West. In the case of the national agency, it will come, there will be a request from the national department, but that must follow some advice from the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Public Service Administration. In the case of a provincial agency, it will follow from a request from the Premier. So they similar, in case of the national one, it's the national minister that initiates the process, even the national minister. In the case of a province, the relevant Premier can match up the request. But then at least they need to consult with the Minister of Public Service Administration and the Minister of Finance before such an agency could be established. And just something which is also different from some government departments is that the proposed initiative of these agencies that there must be a notice in the Gazette that must list all the regional functions of the head of the agency. And it must also refer to the notices of assigned functions. Remember that you stated that when a function is assigned, there must be a notice in the Gazette of the department approves the assignment. And then if desirable, it could also list delegated functions. And then importantly, the notice must indicate the reporting requirements between the head of the principal department in order to enable that head to assist the executive authority with oversight on policy implementation, performance, integrated planning, budgeting, and service delivery. And then the notice may also include administrative or operational matters. And then something else which is also unique to government agencies is that such a notice may also establish advisory consultative board with executive without executive functions or the agencies. So it wouldn't be an executive body, or merely advisory consultative board. Again, to use the UIS as an example, the current board could become a consultative board and advisory board if the UIS is to become a government agency, as an example. Then this lastly to list the main differences between departments and government agencies. A government agency would be a body established to perform specific functions. Unlike the government, an agency would not have a core policy development function. And here, what you use the example of current the Department of Social Development to develop policies for the Minister of Social Development. But if the Social Security Agency is already established as a public entity, it could have been established as a government agency. Then it wouldn't have any policy development functions that will still remain with the National Department of Social Development. And then unlike most departments, agencies may have assigned functions to accompany direct accountability. And then a government agency is, unlike a department, is partnered with a particular department, which must assist the executive authority with oversight. And then contrary to the department, the agency may also have an advisory or consultative board. And then lastly, just in relation to government agency notes, I think that what Aditya also indicated at the beginning, there could be a mechanism to bring back the public service into peace and outside public service. These are functions that should rather be performed by institutions within the public service. There could be public entities that, you know, that was created that should be brought back to the public service. And all my colleagues need to continue now. In terms of the current public service, it's possible to transfer employees from one post to another inner department or from one department to another department without that interview consent and without following the interview process. That's if you just read the Public Service Act. Now, in the rule, provisions made for chances within the public service and then also continents to and from the public service. But it comes from continents to go on our own employees and also transfers within the public service. We firstly provide it could be done with the employees' consent and with the officer ideal scenario. But we can say that the employee doesn't want consent. Then, first of all, the department must follow this process. First, consider the employee's representations as to why he doesn't want to be transferred or seconded. And then, secondly, even if you're after considering these, then it also indicates that there is a real public interest requirement why the person should be transferred to a particular post. So those are the provisions dealing with secondment and transfer. And then now a third provision proposed in the bill. There is a current provision, but it's to some extent led to some confusion. And also its application was somewhat limited. It doesn't apply to organs of state in general. So we now propose that the city provision for continued employment despite the transfer of an employee within the public service. So if a person is transferred from one department to another, I think it's clear, and this is the way we apply to currently, there is no break in service. The person is staying in sentinel service and she's leave credit. But then the important one, which is now called, is that when a person is even transferred from an institution outside the public service, which should be an organ of state, for instance, a public entity, then there will be continued employment and there will be recognition of pension of service and leave credit. There may be other conditions of service, just to mention a few of the main ones that often arise when a person is transferred to the public service. And this is, for instance, if a person in a parliamentary service applies for a post in the public service and the UC is successful, then you can recognize the pension of service. Then an aspect that the RDC referred at the beginning is the issue of enhancing compliance. You'll see one of the main points in the earlier talk was the issue of the to make it clearer. Now there's a proposal in the bill that the Minister of Public Service should be able to conduct investigations and make binding decisions in the event of a finding of a contravention. So this is a new provision proposed in the bill. Now, in order to avoid duplication between the work done by the Public Service Commission and the Minister's investigation, there's a requirement to notify the Public Service Commission before an investigation is conducted, and then subsequently they should also be informed of the outcome of such investigation. In additional compliance measures are a requirement on executive authorities to discipline conservation and heads of departments. Currently, one supposes implies that persons should be disciplined, but there's no strict provision in the Public Service Act like in the PFMA that you must discipline head of department that contravenes the public service precept. And similarly, heads of departments who are responsible for discipline staff in their departments, that they should also be obliged, if there's transgression by employees, to discipline them. Now, these transgressions must also be reported to the Minister of Public Service Administration, who in turn must at least annually report these to the relevant committees of the National Provincial Legislature. So in the case of the national semi and the NCLP, and also as indicated the provincial legislature. And this is also similar to what you would find in the CFMA and federal legislation. Something else which we had to increase was in the case of the Public Service Act, different to the CFMA, much of the powers are vested in political office bearers, either ministers or MECs or premiers. While in the case of the public finance management, it's just an official. And often you reform discipline, political office bearers, national ministers, and we actually have something else in order to achieve justice and enhancement and compliance. So we propose that the Minister of Public Service and Administration to report translation to translation national external authorities like a minister to cabinet. If a secret national minister is not complying with the Public Service Act, they need to be reporting to cabinet. And in the case of NHCs, and the Minister of Public Service report that to the relevant provincial cabinet, but that should be done via the relevant premier. And then often someone else must report on the Minister of Public Service and premier that are not complying. So that's some, I think there's a different other control measure for that.
As you all be aware, but currently the head of department has the power to dismiss employees in this conduct. While the Smart Court provides that the chairperson of the hearing must pronounce sanctions. With regard to the Smart Court for employees on level 1 health, that is regulated in terms of collective bargaining. Whereas for senior management members of employees at senior management level, the minister that provision on Smart Court contained in the ministerial determination, but however, that permission is more similar to the one that you will find in the collective bargaining that relates to the Bismarck Code for Employees Level 1 Act. In the current process with regard to Bismarck hearing, the employer appoints the chairperson of the hearing. And the employer also appoints the person that must represent the employer at the hearing. So the employer appoints both the chairperson and the employer representative. And if the employer make the findings, and the findings to be ensured, he or she must then, in terms of the collective agreement, pronounce sanctions. For employees on level 1 up to 12, the code does provide for an internal appeal process, whereas for senior management the members, there is no appeal process, if you look at the So the question then arises, if an employee doesn't appeal or if there is no appeal, may head of the department firstly amend the findings, that is, if the chairperson called the employee guilty, can the head of the department then amend that finding to a non-guilty one, or vice versa? Or if the guilty, the finding is a guilty one, can the head of the department then amend the sanction for lesser or lesser sanction? Since the disciplinary process for hearing is aimed at ensuring a due process, the proposal in the bill is that the sanction imposed by the chairperson of the hearing must subject to the proposal is that the sanction imposed by the chairperson of the hearing must subject to any internal process after appeal if it is aimed to be implemented by the head of the department. So there is no provision for the head of the department to either amend or hearing or any other process. So the proposal is that the sanction by the chairperson must just be implemented. What are the reasons for this proposal that whenever a chairperson of a disciplinary hearing is pronounced a sanction, the head of the department must just implement it? Firstly, the employer is the one that is in or runs the disciplinary process at the home. And as I indicated in the earlier slide, the head of the department appoints the chairperson of that hearing. As I indicated again in the previous slide, the head of the department is also represented at the hearing by an employer representative. Mandate to make a presentation on behalf of the department. And this is also to align this provision with the collective argument, and also very importantly to protect the sanctity of our collective argument. Furthermore, it's also to ensure fair procedure and protect the independence of the churches and to ensure that the people continue in the not procedure. There are also questions with regard to implementation of the smart sanctions. My question is, should position be made for a review by the head of department. That is, when the disciplinary process is concluded in the chapter 7, should there be a process for review provided for when the head of department can review that disciplinary process? Firstly, the Labour Relations Act does not require any internal appeal or review. And as you all know, a review process would probably also delay the process already authentic to law. But you know that our disciplinary process in the government department usually takes and and something to also note is that during that disciplinary process, and if there is a proposal for you, the employer remains on the payroll pending an internal review. And this amounts to, since the head of management is given a power to review, this could also amount to a review of the head of this head only. Because remember we said he or she appoints the person to make the decision on this area, and this could be tantamount to the other. So firstly, after the chairperson, he must then pronounce sanction or run the disciplinary process on his behalf, and then again give him or her power to review the disciplinary process that the department has. Further, to continue as to whether there should be a provision made for review by the head of department. A review is the decision of the head of department, the SNRD, also be challenged in terms of promotion for the disciplinary process. And if the findings of some chairs are considered problematic, that should be addressed through training and guidelines to ensure competent persons are appointed as chairpersons now. Or if the shortfall is found to be that we don't have competent chairpersons, the view is that let's rather do that through providing training to our chairpersons and also maybe guidelines on how this is not possible. Sometimes departments charge employees for not performing with misconduct simply not following a more protracted poor performance procedure as discussed in the provision is also made in the deal for institutions or continuation of disciplinary hearings by a new department in respect of alleged misconduct by an employee at least by a former department. So if an employee conducted in the previous department, so there's a provision which makes it possible to continue or institute that misconduct procedure in the new department. So which means that the new head of department may do so, or if requested by the former head, he has to continue or institute the new process against former employee comes from the new department. Something to note, which is also very important, is that the two departments must then cooperate, for example, with regard to the exchange of documents, and also with regard to the issues relating to finishing of written or oral evidence, if there's any evidence that needs to be left in the disciplinary process. There's also a proposal in the bill which empowers the Minister for Public Administration to make regulations on, firstly, the power for chairpersons of disciplinary hearings to summon employees and other persons. Currently, there is no power to make the regulation. So, this is a new proposal. And also, a proposal to the Minister to make regulations on servants of persons and other costs for witnesses that is not yet. What we have also done, which is really not a new thing, is that the bill also now, with regard to the grounds for dismissal, also now aligns those grounds for dismissal with those recognized under the Labour Relations Act. That is, misconduct, incapacity due to poor performance, ill health, as well as professional requirements. Another important provision that you're probably aware of is the one relating to conflict. So what we've done is now, the appointment provision. The period of absence has now been reduced from one calendar month to 10 working days, which is what you also find in the employment of SSS, which is now currently 14 days. So another very important thing is that this is deemed an estimation. If an employee is absent for more than 10 days, that is deemed as an estimation. The reason for that is the accessibility of the smart procedure, so that we don't necessarily have to hold the smart procedure for this employee or this employee for this more than 10 working days. However, it's also very important to note that also made provision for a reinstatement procedure, wherein if the employee shows good cause why he or she was absent for more than 10 working days, then there's a procedure that can be followed to retain that employee instead of taking it in or having it dispatched. And this is to accord, the provision that we are now proposing is to accord it with the Children's Court of Appeal Declaration, which is with dealt with a similar provision which is defined in the government of the so it is this provision where an employee is absolved and he or she is deemed 12 retired. So it is mentioned that this is misled by operational flow. That is why we say it's not necessary for world and it's not necessary for this regarded as under operational flow. And it was further mentioned in the case that it is not even in conflict with the Labor Relations Act and the Constitution for the hearing was not with the as we said there is a reinstatement procedure that can be followed if the good shown cause shown by the employee why he or she could not report abuse for more than 10 years. And the objective of this provision that it has been reasonable and so there's another provision as well which deals with issues relating to bargaining and possibility. The proposal is that if an employee is unable to fulfill his change of contract for reasons other than poor performance or ill health, for example, a long period of imprisonment, which is to be prescribed by the regulations by the minister, but the effect is that the contract automatically terminates because it's obvious the employee could not fulfill his change of contract. And the employee is again in this situation deemed to resign, just like as I said, to resign to appointment or a period of absence for more than 10 working days. However, similar to the similar provision that we dealt with on appointment, there is also a provision for reinstatement procedure that can be followed so that the employee can then retain again. Another proposal is the one relating to the prohibition on reemployment in the public service. Prescribed set of employees dismissed prescribed categories of misconduct. Remember, whenever there is a usage of the word prescribed, that would be prescribed by regulating the union. So the emphasis here is on misconduct related to corrupt activity. So different tenures may be prescribed by regulation for different categories of misconduct. And furthermore, one or more categories of misconduct may have not prescribed period, meaning that therefore there was no prohibition on reemployment. That person would not fall under the category where if he or she is found being to be misconduct, that person may not be misconduct. That person falls under that category. Then the prohibition won't apply. And I think that's where I would end. And then he would then continue with that slide.
And currently you will find Section 30 of the Act place or required employees before they engage in outside remunerated work, they must obtain the permission of the relevant executing authorities before they can do so. But in addition to that, there's also a provision which states an employee must apply the hour of his time at the state for 24 hours. And we also agree that it's still not in line with the basic conditions of employment act and therefore it's proposed and involved that this provision be removed. But then when it comes to employees requesting to do outside remunerated work and assuming work outside the employment in a particular department, even if they want to do work for another department against remuneration, they need permission. Should at least include some criteria about on which an executing authority should make a decision whether to grant or not to grant approval. So these two criteria that we propose to include is the person should the executing authority should consider whether there's work that the person can do would interfere or impede the effective and efficient performance of work of the employee. Employee applies to conduct work every evening of a week then surely there might be a negative impact on his day work or his day job in the public service. And then secondly, some of the work may result in a contravention of the code of conduct if he constitutes a conflict of interest for particular work. It's maybe debatable, but for instance, if the leisure sector working also then work for security company, that may be problematic in certain instances. So the sector's position is dealing with the so-called moonlighting. There's been concerns raised by some employees that they apply for permission to be out of the night of work, but then the employer takes too long to respond, and sometimes then that opportunity falls away. Obviously, that is unacceptable, and the decision should be given to the employee within a reasonable time. We don't have any particular in the bill to force the employer to make a decision, but if this is an issue for the person, maybe we could probably look at something to bring the employer to make a decision and for the employee to take the matter further. Because the one option is for the employee to submit a grievance, but it also is for it that the grievance is quite long to resolve. So if there's another grievance that they didn't approve the, or consider the application for African related work, that may take another 2 or 3 months. So that may not be a solution. Then grievances, which I referred to just now, these are especially actually specific part of the grievances. Now currently employees grievances, there must first be an attempt to resolve that within the department, because obviously it's best to resolve the dispute as close as possible to the region. Now this process is going to the rules prescribed by the Public Service Commission on how this should take place, and it's time frame prescribed as well. Now if it's not resolved even by the head of the department, then it goes to the relevant minister, senior or even chief of the department. And only if it's then still not resolved, then the person could refer it to the Public Service Commission. But also it should be noted that if the department doesn't adhere to the timelines in the rule, then the employee is entitled to immediately approach the Public Service Commission. So there is some leeway, you know, for the employees to take the matter further if there's no resolution in the time frame in the particular department. Now, so this is the current position. Now, there's a difficulty with head of departments. Now, their grievances are most likely to be about the relevant minister or premier or MEP, who are in actual fact their bosses. There is no purpose to tell their name of the first resolve the dispute internally, because it's not going to happen. So we propose in the bill that head of departments be allowed to submit their grievances directly to the Public Service Commission. So there's a direct approach to them from the Commission. And then another proposal in the bill is that, and this relates to the difficulty that currently occurring in some instances. The first time the department hears about the grievance or complaint by an employee, then they get a dispute referral form from the bargaining council. They're not even aware that the employee is dissatisfied with something. So we propose that employee, before they can approach the relevant bargaining council to repair unfair wages practice or unfair dismissal or whatever, they must first use the grievance procedure of the Public Service Commission to try to resolve the dispute within the department. But we're not compelling them to wait until the Public Service Commission resolves the matter. So at least in the charge, or at least follow the procedure at the level of the department, and if it's still not resolved, then they could go ahead and approach the relevant bargaining council in relation to unfair labor practices or unfair dismissal. Now the question obviously is, now what if the department doesn't get the timeline for the ones for meeting with the decision? So once again, our anticipation is that once the time is prescribed for resolving the dispute within the department, the person been allowed to approach the bargaining council in session. Now, from the people right, you will note from section 36, the current provision in the Act dealing with political rights of employees. There's provisions for existing employees to decide as public entities, political meetings, the Senate makes speech, and things like that. Do you have to view that these rights are adequately dealt with in the Constitution and also the limitations that we require are currently in the Code of Conduct, which is contained in the Public Service Act, but we don't need to regulate this in the Public Service Act? And for some of you, we do think it's necessary to regulate each of the candidates for interviews for legislation, whether national or provincial. But currently, it's only partly regulated in the public service regulations and not in the public service itself. So the proposal is that employees who be allowed to be candidates, but it's subject to pre-start conditions. In some specific conditions in the regulations that consider that candidates and undertake to and then obviously the Code of Conduct will also apply to them saying comments cannot use your office to prejudice or to advance the interests of a particular political party. And then only those candidates which are elected and then they decided to accept the election and then they are deemed to have advanced in the public service and the data service in the business. The reason for this proposal is that there's a view that if you look at the Constitution, there's clear provision that employees should be invited to these candidates. And for this, we're not going to impose limitations that we can't outside the liberty of these candidates. In terms of this, you may not be elected, so then the sure person is out of job. So that's why we think this is a reasonable then to come through the latter courses of the bill, you would also note that the provision dealing with spouses and letters to make regulations are also proposed to be replaced. Now, this is mainly amended to align it with the areas that the letters should make norms and standards on, and we also attempted to simplify in the Act, because you will see this quite a lengthy one with a lot of detail. But in particular with the use of the term employment practice, which is now defined, we don't need to go into all those kind of detail that you will find in the current provision in the Act. And then something else which is, I think it needs to be noted, that currently the Act authorizes the making of regulations for deviations from the regulations. They will find in the current public service regulations, the Minister of Public Service Administration may allow another minister or an employee to deviate from the regulations if it's against the law. Now, this power currently cannot be exercised with effectiveness. And we've been approaching a number of cases where we think it's justified to exercise that power with effectiveness. And therefore we think there should be express provisions being made in the Act. Because the law advisor told that if there's no express provision for it in the Act, then you can't have such regulations. The proposal is that to provide for that, but then we also thought it's good to include something to say that the exercise of this is effective power must be in the public interest. And secondly, my apologies for left out of the presentation, it may not be to the detriment of the employees. You can never exercise the power that you affect the existing rights of the employees. But we explicitly put that into the regulations. And then secondly, it's also to be noted, the regulations doesn't deal with matters of legal interest. Those matters are dealt with in collective bargaining. So we're not, the intention is not to include that in the entire authority even on the current action. The regulated matters of use of should be a matter of collective bargaining. So it's only if it's in the public interest and not to this to the detriment of the interview. Now the last area is dealing with delegation of powers. Now, currently the Public Service Act only authorizes an executive authority to delegate certain functions. There's only three sections in the Act that express provision for delegation. We find it quite problematic because even if they wanted to delegate from the MEC of Health, want to delegate powers to the head of the hospital, the MSF, or I can't delegate. We propose that similar to the Public Funds Management Act, there should be comprehensive provision for delegation of all functions directed by the Act and regulations, firstly in executive authority and in the ministers, and secondly also the powers in the departments. It's important whenever you delegate functions, you can impose conditions. You can often report on how they exercise those powers. And then secondly, even if a person delegated a function, the original function, for instance the MC, they still exercise their powers, and secondly, they remain accountable for how those functions are exercised. So when you delegate a function, you don't delegate accountability, you remain accountable. So therefore, you need to impose adequate conditions to ensure that those powers are exercised appropriately. If it's not exercised appropriately, you can withdraw the policy or the vote. So those are the proposals on the agenda.
Thank you.
Understand what was it that I wanted to ask. You mentioned something about when you apply, it's either you or a person in the department, when she or he applies for a job. I was just thinking, why should a person start saying, yes, I applied for a job, I didn't, then he doesn't succeed to begin to put up a case out of that. Because even if you are in the department, you know when you apply, you know I'm going to succeed or I fail. Why when you fail, you begin to say it's unfair practice?
I want to make a quick comment or a question on the government agencies as well. That includes about 6 to 8 slides from the presentation. Can I do it? I'm a tough question on each.
No, I'll keep it as well. I know the witness to you, I can go to that. If you go slide by slide and they take the point, and at the end, the general, we will give it to you, have to say. But I'm trying to speed up the process. Slide 9, government agencies, are they questions?
Can we at this stage get a decision or a view on the cost implications of establishment of these agencies? And can we also have maybe an idea on how many posts are we talking about if we establish the agencies?
Slide 10, government agencies again. Slide 10. Slide 11. Okay. Slide 12.
Can I try on 11, please?
Yeah.
I think today we were talking about the first agency that will be established. I think it's recording the agency, the Center for Public Service Innovation or something like that. And that's what it's about. I'll have to do it. I want to do it.
Slide 12.
So where do you like the in code of conduct?
Where are you? Are you 12?
Yeah, but nowhere in the slide. And you decide there's some way that you can say the minister got certain powers that there is a code of conduct or anything, because if this agency does not fulfill its contract, whatever, somewhere must be somewhere code of conduct.
Do you have a question on slide 13, government agencies? On 14, are you with us? A minute?
Can I not put my question on the first agency? What will the role be of that agency and what will it actually do? And on which level will the head of that that agency be?
Thank you, Chairperson. I seek clarity on the second bullet.
The mic is
on the second bullet, Chairperson.
Okay, it's
like 14.
very set purpose that is set up for public service and so on and so on. I don't know whether my reading or my understanding is incorrect. Does it suggest that the sender becomes the principal of the department, or in which case the department is subordinate, or is it the other way around? That's the clarity.
Slide 15. Slide
15. Yes, Chair.
Yes, please.
Why all the time should the establishment of these changes be informed by advising the Minister of Public Service and or stroke Minister of Finance? I'm not saying I'm against it, but I wonder the chemistry behind that statement.
Slide
17 minutes. Yes, I think. In that slide, we're talking about something to the department agency may have advisory or consultative boards. My question is, will that board members be remunerated for the getting money for the development?
Slide 18.
It was still on 18 on deployment, or my understanding was that even with the current system, if you deploy an employee into another or transferred into another department, he still retains those pensions and leave and so forth. So what are you saying now?
On slide 19, does it mean that the Public Service Commission is completely excluded from participation in the investigation? Or is it going to be, it's not just going to be notified, but also being invited to be part of the investigation?
Slide 20. Slide 23.
Someone in witness. 27. 28. Ground of dismissal.
29. Could they explain this ground of dismissal amongst other things? You have ill health. Should I be dismissed because of ill health when I've been working in the department for so many years, and perhaps I even inherited that due to my work or something like that?
Sure,
on incapacity due to poor performance, is there any provision for retraining as is the case in, for instance, in education?
Inspector General. 29, absconding.
Yes, Chair. You know, if you put a restriction to declare that person as having resigned after 14 days of disappearance, what about when a person meets an accident somewhere in Gauteng, he comes from the Eastern Cape, he lies in hospital, not being known where he or she is, and you consider that as being a scorn man.
So the mitigating factor will be ideas. Do you have any impossibility to test this like testing? The one prohibition on re-employment is dismissed for misconduct.
I don't know, somehow I just feel uncomfortable with that. Aren't you putting up some prescriptions on that you just cover up every situation?
I presume.
Yeah.
The 32 outside the university work supervisor.
Sir, I understand this remains referred to senior management and so on. I am a bit worried about the lower levels of employment, levels 1, 2, preference, so on. For instance, where you find an example was made of something with mooning. What was it? Moonlighting, which is largely experienced in hospital. There are other employees who do other businesses outside the formal employment of government. Largely because of wages that are incompetent with the private sector. How then do you deal with the to end? How does this proposal deal with the question of remuneration? To do two things: first, to lift the standard of the the wage, the pay standards of these employees. But secondly, to avoid them the temptation to go into other employment. It may not necessarily be during the working hours, but certainly it does have an effect on the performance at work.
Thank you, Deborah. Are you still on 32?
That's outside of the zoom work for me. That's a very dangerous work. Do you take the APC test, or do you take the alpha part? If you say you may apply for this, and the minister or whoever it was a person and can't do this, then you say to all the departments in the public service, and it can cause damage to the department. Because if you're a policeman or you're a nurse or you're somebody, you want to earn extra money outside, I don't think that will be effective. I don't think you can work with it. I would suggest you skip this whole issue here for the outside work.
conflict of interest with my honorable member. I think on this issue, indeed, we must have some conditional provisions. I'm just thinking of something, Chair, like when the President said it is there's something wrong when you have a person who has been working earning pension or part of his during that period some part was going for pension in his or in her life, and when she gets out she gets an old age period, you cannot give him the pension, the old age pension, because he earns pension from the working period. He said something is wrong there. I'm saying in this case we must start looking into the remuneration of employees before we put our foot on this issue, because people do it really out of hunger and insufficient wages.
Slide 33, grievances. Slide 34, political rights. Supervisor?
Yes, Secretary, I want to quote the one said case situation here where an employee was expelled last year. I'm not so sure whether the case is now complete. I think it is completed. Because he was seen campaigning for a particular political party. It's not clear whether it was during working hours or not. But even if it was during working hours, how does this proposed bill protect a person from doing political work for his political party, not necessarily using, for instance, the resources of the office he occupies, but using the resources of the organization that he belongs to? Is the protection covering all of that, so that you don't have a whole lot of people dismissed because they were seen doing work for their police department?
Delegating power, delegation. We're about to give over to you quite the number of questions.
To ask a bit of a general question, but referring to function. I wasn't very sure, Chair, when we went through the slides, whether it was correct or incorrect. You know, I'm not speaking for workers, but I think I come from the working class background. There is currently a headache about employment agencies in the private sector. Among the functions that you may delegate to this agency is the topic to say an agency may be delegated to perform employment functions once more, referring to the lower levels of employment, because that is where the problem lies. To the extent that you begin to erode the bargaining powers of workers through the use of agencies.
Okay. I'm handing over to you. I'm not sure whether I am a consultant. Can you, what do you want to, maybe to address in that last question? We are all here. We are all lawmakers at the end of the day. Therefore, if just raise a specific one so that we can discuss how to do this.
Yes, that's what I actually mean. Can you delegate the employment function and to an agency? And I'm referring specifically to these lower levels of employment where you have a huge bulk of workers whose bargaining powers get eroded by this type of employment.
Now, initially he said it's not on the slide, but it's a general question. But it's a very important and deep question.
General question about now.
A colleague was saying that he wants to ask a general question. It's not on the slide, but he wants to know from his background of operation as a worker representative. You are faced with this, and you are still faced with this kind of problem. When you say you refer to us to agents, is there provision in the law that is made? I think it's important that we do not just do this.
I think maybe as you were guiding us, but that the response to the questions on slide by slide, but then we'll get to the second round when we look at that general. But the question that the Honorable Member Gwabadra is raising is actually a contained in like 12. It's just that he raised it. What is there, that's why I said when we deal with this question, allocation, that is one area that we are going to address. How far are you going in terms of this? So maybe let's say if they may comment on that for now, it's fine, but if not for now, we may develop it further when we would come to the general question.
Well, we're given a packet and maybe go through all of them together and let's go to these and run. Okay. 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 Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. When a person is advertised in the newspaper, obviously supplies as well as external people. So there's no real tactics on promotion that is, because it's open to everyone. But there is some department that has policies in place which say this client, we're only going to advertise both above level 10. If they do that into upwards, we'll advertise the new focus. So they have a practice of allowing people within the public service. So they have preference actually before candidates from outside to apply for those posts. I don't think this will would still be permitted unless we change the regulations to do this. Because in some cases people argue that you should, you know, allow your people to develop and give them opportunities to go to a higher post in the public service. But currently, as indicated, for senior management service posts, it must be advertised and it's open to competition. So I think that factors, as I explained, I hope that's what you understand, that would still be possible. But there may be an argument from the public side of why don't we advertise all posts, you know, in the to be open to everyone, there's many unemployed people. So that's something, you know, really need to be written into the act itself. It should be done, but currently the minister could determine by regulation.
The question on the promotion, how do you promote the promotion practice is not a matter of saying, how do you reward your performance? Currently, in the
Just to add to that, if a person performs at a factory and that's the percentage of it also varies, the person will get one salary month in that year. But in a part it is a system of grade progression from getting from level 11 to 12, which was abandoned in 2000. But there is proposals which I think will be incorporated in the rating policy review to bring that back. If you're in a post for 3 years or 5 years, that you automatically progress to the next level. Because it seems to be a desire to reverse to such kind of arrangement that they had, you know, prior to 2000 for current events. So often as they were applied for posts, they were never successful, but you're doing good work where you are and you want to remain in the party. So that's something that's probably in the pipeline. And then there was a question about, you know, if a person in a party applies for a post and then they're unsuccessful, then why do they fear unfair labor practices? They feel they're the best candidate, and someone else will promote. So that's why they. And sometimes it may be, they may feel that the process is unfair, the interview that was conducted was not fair. But I can tell you, in many departments, there's a number of these kinds of issues regarding to internal candidates applying for biases, they're unsuccessful. It may be an external candidate appointed, or a person from another part of the appointed. So it does happen, unfortunately. And we don't think it should. Because there's also an argument, even an employer should appoint who they think are best for the post, and that's the end of the story. As long as the post is accepted. Does that answer your question?
Yes, but it still poses a a question mark. Whenever I apply, I go for an interview, I fail. If I fail, I will always find it unfair, because I went there hoping to get the post. So where do you end? You know? So, I don't know.
But in some cases, you don't succeed because the head of the decision maker of that particular they have embroiled themselves into the process, not allowing you to come in because this has that's why you cannot just call it not succeed. The reasons must be followed up.
When you have access to information, it's actually to make sure that the justice is done. And very in terms of but the opinion that I read is actually very relevant that it will keep on there because it's natural. When I apply and go for interview, I'm looking forward to getting the job. If I don't have any job, but it may be clarified to a point that you are under now.
Okay. Yeah. Go on.
Because it's on. Okay. First question is about the cost of education. Now, I just thought that my experience in terms of the challenge. These are the proposals must be tried. You know, what is the base? What we have in place is then a process whereby the target must be done. What's the rationale for creating public institutions? What is the service delivery model? What changes need to be affected in inflation? What is it going to be cost? So we have to do that on a case by case basis and develop the business case. We have such a system on people policy. Now, one more on the, okay, so the cost will be calculated per faculty. But of course, you know, the function that a government agency will perform before any of so that function will go over to the government and then staff, the current staff on my staff, so it's not that topic. When you set it up, the new organization chart, yes, there could be new positions, new management positions. Another advantage that is bringing down costs is you can share services with your principal department in terms of maybe all the capturing of your personnel transactions, but you decide on who to appoint.
So it's much cheaper than establishing a public agency. But the costs need to be calculated first. Okay. That's why we also need to involve the Minister of Finance. There was a question of introducing of the business case. There was a question, why the advice of the Minister for Public Service and the Minister of Finance? That's exactly those two ministers not the same. The Minister of Finance, National Treasury, will assess the cost of budget financially viable. And our minister will look at the function, should this function be transferred or assigned to and what's the service that it involves. So that is why the two ministers, we've got the purpose of asking advice of us to assess that business from the take appropriate particularly when we approach Parliament. How many posts will be created in terms of a government agency? It depends on the organization structure and the current service that goes over to your government agency. The current posts go over. It depends on the size of the agency, but job relations will determine the levels of what the level is. The first agency, the Center for Public Service Innovation, what is the functions of that center? What is the level of employment? The center conducts research on innovation. They do research itself or they contract themselves. So they sit back and try to be think independently on what innovation can be incorporated into the public service. That's why we see them a little bit independent from the DPS. Similar to university, where you conduct and focus. Your main function is to serve. You need to serve that and not be part of the department. That's why we are the reason why we have a little bit of the department. The level of employment, one of the previous heads of the CEE is one for the deputy director. So that is absolutely the CEE level, because you're higher than that, for the people who are in the question. But I think shopping relations. So the role of the CP, there was a question about the Center for Public Service versus the Principal Department. Now, the Center for Public Service Innovation has any government agency forced to the Principal Department for getting money from the Principal Department. So the Principal Department is under the policy, the provision under which this agency, any government agency, must operate. So the Principal Department is very important in shaping that whole relationship, how the government agency will be operated. So it's not a question that, the center will drive the DPSA or the government agency will drive it for the land. Rather than determine the policy, the government agency sees on it. It's the framework provided by the department. That is the principle. My board members be remunerated? Yes, we are proposing advisory board. And yes, we say the board members are remunerated. Some of these government agencies, some of these boards could be high-profile people. They could have high-profile people to advise. So they will be remunerated for the meeting. Travel is a cost and subsistence, will be covered. But public servants will not be remunerated. So those were the questions that were the most common.
Can we maybe take a 10-minute human rights break?
Yes, and the tea is ready. We will come back to all of
you. Yes, for the sector, the agency's looking there was questions about performances for agencies.
greater question arises and then we break up. The question was, code of conduct, what if agencies perform with their to who are implementing conduct, code of conduct?
It's just that if someone has a public entity, what happens when a public entity is that report? That minister is accountable for that particular property, is accountable for that function. And then that minister must decide if the body is a public entity, incorporated into a government agency, back in the report, if the government agency comes to perform, there should be remedial actions before she can hold the head of the agency accountable. So, you know, there's some disciplinary
But the deadline today, that's why we're pushing. Some April, you take for the
come on,
again, no,
okay, can you again? Okay, you just do
in the case of the public service, it's really service level requirements and stuff, but there are the needs in this place and things like that. So that's where I was, you know, she wanted to say what it means. Because maybe, when we were just talking now, maybe we should move away from this term public interest. We just use in other legislation as well, but maybe in our case it's clearly it's about service delivery requirements. Even the current act says you can transfer in the public service. But then also it's an objective test. We don't say if the employer thinks it's in a public interest or obviously it's can't say anything. But the court will apply objective test. If you say in the opinion, then they say, well, if the common employer say, I think that then it can't really detect it. So that's why the court wants to be an objective test. I think that's a test better protection to the employee. There's a question to explain the issue of transfer to employees. As you indicated, currently you can transfer employees without this consent if you look at the Public Service Act. What we noted is that obviously if the person consents, that's the one example or one possibility. But what if the person doesn't want to consent? Then you must consider the reasons why he doesn't want to be transferred. Maybe it's because of the location of his family or residence. And only then you can make an official agenda's criteria of being in a public interest come to be established in the sector.
Check and can I want some back questions? You know, an employee may agree to be transferred, but that transfer could have cost implications. And you mentioned something about the family, the location question.
metropolitan to far rural areas and so on and so on. Is there any provision for to take care of the cost implication involved there? Again, I raise this because of some experiences in the past through the redeployment processes with regard to the question of relocation to far-flung areas.
Just a follow-up, the problem was that he's a former leader of SATU, so he resolved those problems which SATU had. But I just wish we must think so well on that issue, because it's going to affect us next year because of one single public service, where we need one member with expertise to move from Durban or city of Cape Town to go to the far deep rural areas, and there's some resistance. So, all in bomb. So it needs a lot of thinking and consideration.
Yeah. Consultation, please. A current collective agreement provides for the settlement cost for including the COC transfer. For instance, it allows you to buy property in a new place and then the government refunds your transfer duty, you know, quite substantial in some instances. And there's other parts that are also carried off to transport with your property, your goods, and from your current workplace to new workplace. So there is current provision for that in a collective agreement. And then there's a related question about the provision that we say now allows for employees to be transferred with the retention of their pension and other benefits. As I said, it's in the Act currently, and that's the way we can define, but there's some questions raised about this. We actually have an internal opinion question that we say, if I suppose in DCSA and apply for a post in the bottom staff is unsuccessful, some people argue that the giant is really a point. So we just want to make it clear that it's a provision, that there's no resignation required, continued employment. And obviously the new one is also a current provision, I can call it new, but it's narrower in terms of when a person transfer from an institution, a state institution outside the public service to the public service, to ensure continued service for that employee to protect the social benefits. So I think it's obviously going to be beneficial in this country if someone comes and is valid to the public service, that they should be substituted. Then the questions ask about investigations conducted by our minister or the proposed provision for that, whether the public service commission would be involved. As the provision stands in the law, there's no provision for them to be involved in investigation as such. I would be wary of proposing such a thing, because it might say if they're involved, it will prejudice their own investigation, because the investigation should be independent as an independent constitutional body. But obviously, there's nothing that prevents the minister from asking their views on particular issues regarding the investigation. But to formally include them in such investigation, I think, would be problematic.
So
responding to all that update that was sent. And so some of the questions that I attempted to raise, I can never, we can all have to be the way. However, for SMS level, you may decide to appoint somebody inside or somebody from outside the department. And with regards to the confusion, I think it's very interesting to note that you would obviously need somebody that has some expertise in relation to collecting money and somebody that has a feeling maybe some support. Currently employed in the public services sector, Chile. It's a policy on implementation of incapacity leave and ill health. So there are two scenarios. There's one which is temporary incapacity, depending on the period for which you have been absent from your employment due to ill health. And there's another one which is permanent incapacity, where you are permanently not able to incapable of performing your duties. So what happens if you are permanently incapable, then you are then discharged. And I've been informed that in that situation, the benefits that you get are actually very, very good as well. So maybe the usage of the word dismissal might be the one that is creating a problem, but that's what the word that they use in the labor system. But the effect is that you will be charged due to your failure to perform as a result of permanent illness, or being permanently incapacitated due to illness. And I think the other question relates to the requirements for incapacity due to performance. What you do at that rate, why does they come to you and say you are not performing, therefore you are dismissed? The answer to that is that there's a process that must be followed. Like you try and place a person in another job that you think that person would be suitable or be able to perform better. You take the person for a training and the staff or try to rescue the person to perform other duties within the practice. And if that process is undertaken and still the person just cannot perform, therefore you might have sufficient ground to say then we terminate services. But as I said, it's a criteria that must be followed, a process that must be followed if you believe that the person is not performing. Other question related to abscondment. What happens if an employee is lying in hospital and then he or she cannot come to work for those days that are stipulated there? As I said during the presentation, we also make provision for a reinstatement process, wherein if the employer comes back and show good cause why he or she could not avail himself for duty, then the department can reinstate that employee. I mean, in this case where somebody is lying in hospital, maybe in a coma, and there was no way that
he or she could inform the employee about the absence, then I'm quite certain that if a situation like that happens and the employee recovers and comes back to the department and makes a decision that I could not come to work for anything because I was lying what people and they told on us, I'm sure the reinstatement would take place and I'm such a company.
Are you responding to that of your feelings of the stipulated in the law?
Just to add to that, I was just also thinking, now this is a problem because he is saying, I am sure. it must be there, you know.
I'm saying I am sure because the law does provide for that. I mean, if the person says no, you can't, obviously you have to give the reason why you think another person.
I think we may just have to tighten our system like that. We don't end up dealing with you know, once in your record, in your history, that you were one dismissed and then reinstated. You know, it's a problem. I just think that before we take any decision, we'll actually make an effort. That is the best we can do. Make an effort to then say, it is an equitable second process. So that I don't think my report is only our decision. Because there are posts involved. It's just that sometimes we don't post the security. Not the post of the department sitting administering a dismissal. There's a post involved. And only at a later stage you realize that no, your employment were not supposed to dismiss that person. I mean, I think maybe when we deal with these things beyond question for clarity, and what we are actually going to address ourselves, to how do we deal with it, it might be an emotional move sometimes.
If I might say something here, you dismiss somebody, and then you say, but now, detention, everything is dismissed. So then you must go and reinstate him again. You say, because I want to know whether if a person is lost, he comes back after 5 months, and you reinstate him, what happened to his all his
my concern is the person is today dismissed particular department, very serious misconduct, could be financial misconduct, and there's nothing currently that prevents them from applying for another department and to be appointed. There's nothing. And that department can appoint them. Obviously, some of them will say no, that they will be concerned. And we think the proposal is that it's time now to look at introducing a prohibition for a particular period. Obviously, the concern might be that maybe there's too much discretion to prescribe this. It can be quite difficult to define categories, because there's some categories you might feel, I'm always using an example of insubordination, it's obviously quite particular to the department. Do you want to prevent that person from coming back to another department where there's different heads or people in the department, but maybe it's tendency for insubordination, so it's very difficult to write this into the role, but obviously it will be led by the commission in terms of proposal that we're making, whether we should tighten it up further. Then there was questions about the school dealing with a person's employees wanting to do outside generated work. I'm going to try to all, I think there's three questions pertaining to this. And obviously, as you said, there's a sensation for low-level employees to want to do outside generated work because they're not earning much. Now, I'm not going to enter into the field of whether employees are adequately remunerated or not, but you may be aware of that they're starting to look now, I think it was in the president's speech, into health workers to increase their salaries. And then also, they're also looking at lawyers, potentially improved access and improved access and prosecutors. Those employees might be also looking at the police service. So that could be dramatic, which I think that's one area which we don't necessarily can address in this. For us, the important thing is that we should have employees that are able to give us their full 8 hours a day and are effective in that work, in doing their work. And then secondly, that they shouldn't go and do work after hours or their leave days that conflict with the work that they doing their partners. For instance, if our department is out for something, now this employee is applied to do that work or to tender for that work. Obviously, that will create an unequal conflict of interest if that happens. So that is the provision. As it stands, if we remove this provision, then employees would be entitled to do outside generation work because there's no prohibition. So we just proposing to amend the current provision in the Act and say there should be indications in the Act to employers when they make a decision. What should they take into consideration before they make a decision, whether to grant approval or not. So there's a discretion for the employer to give approval or not. So the rule is it's prohibited unless to get approval from the employer to do the such work. Unfortunately, I don't think we're in a position to give a statistic on how many requests there are and how many have been granted or not. But we could see if it's possible, if maybe that's too much work, but maybe we come back again. And if we have some information to share that with you. There was a question on the political rights. I must say, if the person doesn't use work time or use the resources of his employer to exercise his political rights as citizens of the country, they can't be charged for misconduct. It could not be permissible. And I don't see why removing the provision that we have, we actually make it more enabling, I think, the employees to exercise their political rights by removing that clause and the current section, proposing the removal of that section in the Public Service Act. Because now they can never rely on their constitutional rights, so they're exercising that. You can't tell who is not conscious. So I think the only two places where they could charge the person is the person doing work time, because it's often difficult to believe that an infected thing to use work resources to control. conduct a political activity. I mean, that is also a tyranny and not a commerce. I think the last question on, if you help me understand this question and the use of employment agencies, government departments often the HR sections through a procurement process appoint employment agencies to assist them with the filling of posts. I don't know if that's what you were referring to. But then they do the shortlisting and then they submit it to the department, but then often the shortlisting is all checked by the employees of the department and then they convene a panel and conduct interviews with the shortlisted candidates. But then to come to delegations as such, the Act only allow you to delegate the functions, for instance, of a minister or MC or the head of the department to an employee in the public service. You can't delegate any of the powers or currency to any person or entity outside the public service. But I must admit, we may not have understood your question correctly.
Yes, that's a good question to follow up. Our public service does not exist in a vacuum. A public service of South Africa, where we say our justice system, it is based more on restitution than impunity. It's more restorative than the opposite of that. And we also say, by the way, the state that we can tolerate and accept the differences of the religion, for secular. South Africa being a secular state, you find that even the different kinds of religion that are there, including my own, would agree on one point, the recognition of the act of the censure. Now, if you look at this whole position, you then say, why do we legislate in such a way as to be seen not to be mindful about the restorative practices or restitution, and acknowledging this question of repentance. I'm talking about a public servant who may have been dismissed in one department for having committed a serious offense, as we give examples here. Do we want to regulate such that you put a stop and say no more? Or you want to regulate such that you outline a process as to how you can actually go about addressing that? Taking on board this question, these two examples that are given, which I think as we legislate, of course we need to look at the environment and the factors around it that needs to be considered. I think it's not more a question for clarity, this one, but it's more the issue of the clarity may be provided, but we still have to deal with it as we look at it. Why do we do that? What do you think is the rationale? I will not go into the extreme.
I just see you want to know a lot. Yes, Mr. Chief. I'm here as an outside worker. If I think, what is the percentage of unemployment in our country? It's a significant percentage of people are unemployed. Now, if we say, if a person can have his bread, after both sides, can work for the department, and when there's an outside job, you can apply, and you might just get the approval. I would say, let's keep this approval rule and say that clearly, you work for the department, and that's it. You're not going to do outside work, because whilst there's people outside unemployed, that can, apply for the job that is there now,
so we can reduce unemployment. How much one person is going to be better both sides? Can't believe it. Thank you.
Skills.
Put democratic, but you want to fight against that.
What is the burden on people with mental income? It's only for a period, it's not permanent. And we say you can't take it from me, but simply, what's the benefit to them? They with mental income, they join the public sector, and so that's our level. Because it's a problem not even meant for the first of citizens and this mental. And as I said, it's simply for a period. After that,
but no, no, the point is one, the gravity. You can't equate a situation where a person has been shifting funds from the public or something like that, then a conduct within the department and you put it on par. That's where our problem lies.
See, one needs to look at the room, but it's specific to the study later on, I think, in a series after the series, there's a series of one and the person can't do it. The person is here for, and it's all to be informative. And that's a look at the nature of not being a conscious. It's totally conscious. And I think that's the thing that all come in, and you can see the gravity of the change. So this provision in the Act is a limitation on that note. So if you can outside prohibit employees doing other work, it may be unconstitutional. But we haven't as such looked at the issue and obviously take our advice and take the question to provide advice on that note.
Yes, and I think it is also
I
think there is also a code of good practice. I don't see any reference to the code of good practice. I would think that this would be very, very much in favor of an employee who is maybe emailing that the code of good practice is taken from that information. Because it's out there, it will be very technical, and in our way of giving out the benefits, it will be very, very, like, because I think the code of good practice brings in this element of restorative practice in this aspect.
Thank you.
Thank you. The reason why I'm raising this is because in some scenarios you will find a chairperson says that he or she is not compelled to take into account code of good practice. And I think for the sake of fairness that we also in this legislation in fact direct the chairperson of the disciplinary to take into account the code of good practice.
Okay. Do you have a streamline the writing, the expression based on life and general purpose. I'm not sure if we may not be interested, but I shall have 5%, but they won't have a dinner. I'm not sure if I can talk for them now.
No, I tell him why Lisa said that it should follow the flight. I was putting aside the general questions because general questions are forming part of input on the complement. To say, yes, we hear what you say, but this is a direction that we will be heading for as a public representative in the program. So we should not enter into that now. As the Rick correctly saying, this is very similar and correct. But you are not responding to the package in front of you at the moment. If people are taking you away from that line, and you maybe try to follow that. Okay?
Yes, there's one question which has not been what is true. I suppose it may be important, but I think it's important for us to clarify on the enhancing of compliance. Where the Minister for Public Safety and Administration reports the transgression of national DS to cabinet. And I said it is not clear as to where should the minister report the premier, whether to the cabinet or directly to the president.
Correct that we currently don't cover translations for premiers and also the minister itself, which is also experienced by the our department of something. Maybe it's something you all make it go, but I was thinking, it's just my thinking, that maybe these addition some to premiers, that maybe to the report to the president. And then we'll ask the Sorry to make it support them. It's difficult to see that minister in the act. So how do you deal with that? But in the case of pregnancy, maybe a proposal to consider supporting the president. With the president.
Keep that in important one. If you want to have a directive on that, let's say it will help also the
in the slide on the background, we are saying that collective agreement concluded will be considered an ministerial determination. Effectively, what does that mean? What it says for to ensure that the enhanced implementation and compliance. What does it exactly mean in terms of the actual activity of the minister in dealing with the argument for the collective agreement? Also, in the slide, there is a reference to open competition, especially where you deal with the advertisement of senior management level, where you say that in terms of the issue around ethical mobility affairs in terms of your promoting, it is something that you have to subject that to actually open competition. What may be you are talking about the advantage there. Stuff like that. But if you look at it also against the question of a retention of fear, is it not a sort of a threat that it is comment on that one? The third point, in one of your slides, where you talk about advisory board, I think we raised an issue last time which we feel better can do. The question of their role, vis-a-vis the role of the head of department. because the heads of departments, amongst other things, other than just executing, they align functions and responsibilities. They have the responsibility to also advise the executive authorities in terms of the language of the team. Because we're all asking about executive. What would be sort of a jurisdiction issue in a situation where you might find that on a particular issue, the head of department, who is the accounting officer at the end of the day, may be of a view different to the advice that is given to the minister by the advisory board? Would you is actually going to shine? And if the minister end up with taking the view of the board, are we not providing a mechanism that is actually opening up a chances of conflict and that level that may actually even hamper the implementation of policies and services?
First question as to now what would be the implications of the new collective agreement to be implemented in the as I explained, is that when a collective agreement is concluded, we have to subsequently any material to the matter. So every year this salary increase is received to the matter issues, we shall have the salary scales and so on. But obviously there's other details, for instance, your housing benefits, your lease benefits, that we also issue discrimination for that. And firstly, it delays sometimes implementation. And then secondly, this is one of the main reasons why we're proposing this, is that as indicated in other slides, that we're proposing certain compliance provisions in the Act. So if we say this is also material discrimination, so we can use the compliance mechanisms in the Public Service Act to enhance compliance of the collective agreements, because we do experience problems with departments that adhere to collective agreements. On occasion, even four people from our departments who testify on behalf of unions against departments, which is very unfortunate position for us, which is only there to assist departments. But now we want you to complain about them not adhering to collective but similar to the proposal on HIV and the inclusion in sciences, we think the sanctity of collective agreements is their health. So that's a key tool of determining conditions of service in the public service. So that's the main reason. There's nothing more really. I think it's partly administered in nature to assist us, and then secondly, it's just something to enhance compliance. We're not saying this is now something different, just for this purpose regarded to the material discrimination. So I think it's there to assist compliance with collective agreements. And that's the end of it. So there's no other intention to undermine collective agreements. The opposite is actually enhance compliance. And then there's the second question of obviously competition and retention of skills. The open competition principle is not found in the public service as itself. We also not found in the problem that is involved. And it's currently captured in the regulations. So just to note that, the practice that comes from the regulations as such, and as I say, it's limited to a certain level, for others it's a choice. I'm sure there's an argument to say it may obviously narrow your pool to people that, for instance, for a particular post that only employees in the public service can appoint can apply. Then that would at least enable people to move upwards with less competition. But on the other hand, the argument is we want to get changes to the position, whether the person comes from in the public service or outside, that the other kinds of people. Actually, I wonder if we, on this particular point, Now, from our expertise, I think we need someone from our informal practice unit to do as much as he doesn't input on the come here or to get a residue position and to respond to this, because I don't think we have sufficient knowledge about what is the impact either way on this particular patient. Then the last question on the advisory board, there are two kinds proposed in the bill. The one is advisory board for government agencies, and then the other one is advisory board for the Minister of Public Services and State. It's not for any other minister, it's only for our minister. And we said there's certain specialized areas, for instance, e-government, that she may want an advisory board. And I can give you an example. We currently have the General Council, which consists of CIOs, Chief Information Officers from departments all over the public service. And they currently serve informal advisory role to the Minister on some of the current government issues. And we thought this is a way of formalizing, if the Minister so decides, as advisory board role. But obviously, if nothing all issues comes now, then what would be the role of the department? But the advisory board would be specialized advice. But if that advice entails any financial implications, that must be approved by the department that's accounting officer. And if the advice then of this advisory board to the minister differs from that from the department, then the minister and the minister supports the advisory board. The minister must give a written instruction to the accounting officer in terms of the public finance management that before they can move, she can influence. But I understand your issue of there could be a potential for conflict on areas where the head of department said, well, I'm the one who should advise the minister and not the advisory board. What we could perhaps do, because this is not, there's other ministers that have advisory board, this is not, you know, a unique proposal. Just use some other examples as well. But there is obviously intentionality as well, maybe possibility of conflict. The other example we thought in the context of again our minister is the Centre for Public Service Innovation, a quarter link to the government agency is proposing it. Previously there was a board consisting of several DGs, science and technology, expertise on innovation and service delivery, and for them to advise the minister. So you have a broader pool of people, and as I said, could include your own DGs and other DGs as well. For but I think you correct that there is a danger of conflict between, you know, the advice on the two and the case of for government agencies, similar situations that arise with the head of the agency reports directly to the external society, but then there's also known as the advisory board and what is taking conflict in the society. But maybe one way is to clearly describe the limits of, you know, on what the head advice is possible and not to overlap with that of the head of the department. At the end of the day, the head of the department remains, or the agency remains, the accounting officer. But in the case of our minister, the power vests in her, and that's a very little power vested in the details of the respect of public service matters. Perhaps that's not the answer to this question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm coming to the general interest.
Thank you, sir. In general, I would like us to go back to the objective of the financial objectives that were outlined by the director there. And one of them is that the Public Service Act prescribes often not as yet with regard to the organizational elements of statistics and legal systems. And this, in my view, is mainly the mandate
the public service commission. I think you have also made reference to the issue of diversity. Now, when we are saying the minister also has a right in this case, and we think it should be fully in the policy that has been made in the direction of the public service commission. I'm sure that issue is being discussed and fully discussed together with the public service commission, but I thought that now that the public service commission is also under review, although it is not one of the supplemental issues, but also it is being reviewed by Parliament currently. I'm not sure if it would be the right thing to do, but I would like to recommend that those amendments in the bill that have an impact on the operations of the public service commission could be made available to the committee that is reviewing, although we are not preempting the outcome of this review. I think it is important to make this information available. I think it will not influence the outcome of that report, but it will give the committee an opportunity, you know, to make a more informed recommendation or to this against the public service commission. Thank you. Is that a comment?
Maybe the political between the public service commission and the minister taken place, not yet. And this must be one of the concerns of the place that their power is taken.
Also a comment. I think we will realize all of us that it's not a common practice that when the FDA is involved in the wrong question of what happened. But it's just that we did that so that the members of this committee that when we come to the point of considering the question, we will have actually dealt to a larger extent with questions of sensitivity. That we are seeing through the venue and then dealing with the question of content, what it means, whether we have changes or whatever they are making. Besides that, this does not stop at the workshop. So to then say, of course, even as we consider the scheme going forward, we will see if there are questions that need to be done. But also to say, even between ourselves as individual members of this committee and the department, if as you are starting the bill, as we are concerned, you realize that there is an issue for tariffs, we should agree that we may actually see if we can then clarify some of the issues. This also suggests that you might have not adequately responded to some of the issues, but you feel that you want to make a follow-up. So yes, that technically you have responded to this question, but it is not only on pure technical considerations that we're going to pass or not pass the bill, but it's also looking broader in terms of political implications. You might want to also come back to us. I think that would be welcome. That let's take a look at this in the action. Not only at workshop as formally organized, but we keep on doing it like that. Now, the last point, gentlemen, when I said I have 5 points, actually when I said with the other slides, I said to everybody now that we come straight now to only two. The last point, I just want to be unfair. Unfair to yourself. But be fair to the public. If we ask you from a point of view of saying that introducing this bill, we are not suggesting that it is 100%. It's a pure efficient system. And then putting it to yourself and then say, being unfair as I am, if I say, put yourself in our position and imagine it so, because if you are really one of those things, you must be elected. Would your center be switched off or within a public representative and then ask this question? Be honest and talk to us, be yourself. That's why I said I want to be unfair. And would it help that when we take it, we are able to look at some of it? I know you want to build too much, and you can only talk about the important part of the brighter side of it.
Sometimes I want to be off and like, and I want to bother sometimes. You know, you look at this collective bargaining agreement, whatever, the private sector, or maybe even the public sector, the workers there are covered by that. I came here, this is my 6th year in this institution. I hear people complaining about their salary, waiting for the commission, for the Medicare, and all of that. I get annoyed when I listen to them mumbling about that there isn't the structure that it is saying we are supposed to be as public representatives. People that are in the decision making of this country and say we're not happy the way it was being presented or are we treating ourselves. I don't say maybe my comment, but even in all these amendments, that is still not covered. Tomorrow is a caucus. They are also going to mumble, tremble around about this whole thing. You know, I hate to hear that from the leader who claims to be the decision maker of this country. But it's something maybe all of us collectively think about. And I don't say respond to it, I just say, I hate to hear you saying, as lawyers, you don't know what you want. It's just like us. I'm telling maybe a statement general. I know Kay would not sleep when the report comes. Say that, yeah, now it's going to be implemented as one state. Why did we wait for this commission? We don't raise how to do these things. We are the last country in the African continent. The mistake that is made by the African state in dealing with these matters, I don't think we should fall into that. We should create a new dimension throughout the state. I know that Trevor cannot stand up tomorrow. They say, oh, there's going to be increase for the numbers. The whole country is going to be against what we're going to say. But the market, drug and mechanism, and given the
we're ready to interact with yourself in November last year and even today and interact with other institutions and people that are talking about these areas that we think we need to make suggestions to the committee to consider. But, you know, I think the underlying objectives of the amendments also, I think, sound in my view. But there is instances where I think we need to either refine or to deal with certain things differently, or we haven't thought through the implications of the particular proposal in the future. But if we could, with your permission, submit a list of those areas, we would try to do these differently and not say much in much detail. Could you really identify some areas that you think you need to revisit? And obviously you as a role maker, you know,
now it's bigger than it was before.
Yes.
I highly appreciate the level in which you were raising this question. You were not raising questions for the sake of raising questions. You take upon yourself that you are the lawmaker. Nobody knows him without the next generation. Therefore, the next generation must say, oh, my father has done a good job. It's level the playing field. That's why you have to think the way it is. I think it is for this person. Telling the lawyers they must think like South Africans, not say like legally like lawyers. You are a South African. How is this thing going to impact on South African citizens? It's important as an interpretation. If somebody wants to challenge, we are there at least to put the mark. I just
yes, off the record.
Off the record. You say we are the lawmakers. This is Jay, remember, if I am a lawmaker on this country. You can ask him, all that is, you can ask him.
What's the question?
Jay, if I also a lawmaker of this country. I thank you.
Of the GA. Of the GA.
I think that is a very fundamental question that you made. Because the time when the policy for the government is set, we do not expect the opposition to oppose for the sake of opposing. First, take it upon yourself, I'm a South African. Is this what I want or is this not what I want? You understand? You're a lawmaker.
Thank you.
But Chair, outside he told us when the DA comes into power they will just wrap up all this.
Is it possible for us now to get a vote after all these alterations and after everything we've heard this morning and scratching out all the stuff and just get the new bill like stand at this stage on this morning? Just slowly for just a copy like this. I've got a thick one here with all the who's here? I'll say that. But where's all the new stuff? All the new stuff in there.
If we may, I think it's more of formality administration. We so wanted to make sure that all members have a fine. And that this fine manages all the services, including the place that we in insurance thing. Without the TKA saying this thing we are proposing to amend the bill as set. So we will have to check with we are going to attend to that event, then in our matter. We'll attend to that to them saying the make sure that all documents are available. The only thing is I mean just that one says becoming unfair we'll have to actually get the handle, the response that they given. As we get on and on, they are interacting at the moment. There may be a provision from the side of the department which they feel that they either may be thinking of reviewing and stuff like that. That active communication is necessary. So that would be one of the things that we do. But the bill is in a package, the bill is not there. We are going to be sure we take care of that.
Thank you, Ray. I think we've come to the end of it. The last is made of the old assembly. Right.
From the workshop for the strategic planning session, is that we agree that we are adopting a track program. We have adopted a draft program that we all have, and that draft program is saying we are committing ourselves to do what we are saying we're going to do on Wednesdays and Fridays what we are saying is also is that we are going to approach the power that be, that we think 2 weeks of the upcoming constituency period. And we dedicate that to considering the finalizing. That is in April. The other thing is that, as we said, that this is a draft program. It is a draft that we are going to adopt at our next meeting from tomorrow, which is next week, Wednesday. We have requested the stakeholders, all the stakeholders that were there, the KCAGSC and everybody, to come back to us if there are areas where they want to propose that we do some changes here and there by Friday this week. The full report is available. The full report is available. The Secretary will have to give copies to those of you who are not there. When I say the full report, we mean the full report of the workshop, including the program. So that's the thing. In the draft, you may come back to us, giving, because this thing that I was saying, stakeholders may come back to us, does not only mean that it's only them and not us. Also, if you feel that you have got a serious issue on a particular item or a particular date in our program, you are actually welcome to come back. You realize that in as far as the bill is concerned, our next move on the 28th is that we are sitting at the portfolio committee to look at the submissions that we see, plow through them, and then decide as to which of those who made submissions who want to call for public hearing. Because there may be some of them that you just have to look at their submissions and conclude that you don't have to call them. But we have made a provision. If you look at the program, we have made a provision that we will have all of them have their submissions, all of them coming forward. That provision is just to accommodate that if we so decide, we are not found wanting in terms of not having created space in terms of our program. But if we decide that we are satisfied with the written submission of process, we don't want to interact with them, then it means on the day that we are saying we are dealing with this program, with process, so like I'm just giving process as an example. So that is the situation. So if you look at it, the number of days that we have programmed to deal with the bill, very, very, very few practically. Even by half sometimes. It depends on what we do on the 28th. So through you, Chairperson, the homework that we might want to do is that let's be honest. First, be honest to yourself. If you have not yet passed the bill, go and pass the bill. So that, and through all this document, so that by the 28th, we must be able to then say, this is the final direction that we're taking. We might want only a week to get into the informal and the formal stage of consideration and stuff like that, depending on how we get that. But then we can take the process forward.
Thank you. That satisfied the question. Still, I'm available.
But Chairperson, how did you know what he wanted to say? No, I was still expecting him to put his thing.